Hi, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Ginkgo biloba. It reduces hepatic lipid accumulation in high-fat diets that induce non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine in China. I'll get into that. It's all about what's inside of ginkgo. It's a particular phytonutrient labeled GB, meaning it is a ginkgolide, and it's very powerful, and it reduces the amount of fat you have in your liver and ameliorates non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is frequently due to the high amount of sugar, including high fructose corn syrup, as well as, well, fatty foods, the average American diet, which a huge number of people in America suffer from. Historically, if you had a very fatty liver, it was more often than not thought to be due to the amount of alcohol you consumed over what period of time and how much and what percentage of alcohol. No, this is nothing to do with alcohol. This is to do with unhealthy food choices, and that can kill you, and does. So it's good information, good news. So get off of the high fructose corn syrup, and get off the junk foods, and eat a healthy plant-based diet, lots of clean liquids like fresh-made juices and water, and take ginkgo biloba. More on health and healing in just a moment, but also today, several things, some of which we can deal with today, others we're going to deal with on our next program. Yesterday afternoon, Glenn Greenwald, in my opinion, one of the finest investigative reporters in the world. He's the one who broke the story on Edward Snowden when he was at the Guardian in England. Well, he was one of the co-founders of The Intercept. And The Intercept has a good reputation until now. He resigned from his own publication. So we're inviting Glenn to come on next week. He's been on the show many times in the past to discuss this. And what will happen to him now? Because the normal investigative journalist community is censoring an important story. So we'll ask him about that story. If for any reason we cannot have him on, he was on Tucker Carlson last night in a six-minute segment. I'll use that segment. But I'd like to have him on to discuss it. But the reason he resigned is that a person appeared for a full hour on Tucker Carlson this week who was the CEO of a new corporation formed by the Biden family, including Joe Biden. He had met with Joe Biden on several occasions. He had met dozens of times with the other family members. And he's a very successful person, no controversy in his background. He's got a clean resume. And the Bidens don't. And evidently, when he heard that this was all a Russian conspiracy, that Hunter Biden, anything alleged to Hunter Biden was not real, wasn't true, and he felt that he was, in effect, being pillared as a traitor. So he went public. He didn't want to go public. He realized all the flack he was going to take, but he said he had to show that the truth was there. So he brought all these hundreds of documents and audio tapes and credit card receipts showing that he was at that hotel with the Bidens and all the deals they had going. And boy, does it paint a terrible picture of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Joe's brother, who's been living off his largesse for 47 years. It looks more like an organized crime family. Now, of course, nobody would want that if you were supporting Joe Biden. And I don't really think there's a difference. They're both terrible candidates, in my opinion. That's my personal opinion. I've always voted for independents. I've never voted for a mainstream physician because I know how corrupt they are and the corrupting influences behind them. In any case, that would have put the kiss of death upon that if the public knew about it earlier. Turns out the FBI had this information for a full year. Had the laptop, Hunter Biden's laptop. He took it in to get it fixed and forgot it and left it there. And so finally the shop repair guy looked in it and found all these documents and gave it to the FBI. The FBI did nothing with it, but the guy kept a copy. And that's how we found out about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't know any of this. And here's why this is important. I hope Glenn Greenwald is able to address this on the show. Why is this important? Politicians are always offering access. The Clintons were notorious. Obama was notorious. Obama didn't write a single sentence in Obamacare. It was all written by the insurance industry and other special interest groups that profited from it. Well, because when we elect someone to office, there's the assumption that this person will have some level of integrity that exceeds their own selfish personal or family interest. But then all we have to do is look at how Nancy Pelosi ended up with over $100 million fortune on a government salary. How is it members of Congress can engage in insider trading that if you and I did, we would go to jail? And they're sitting in all meetings knowing which companies are going to merge. That gives them a huge opportunity. If they know the two companies are going to merge, you suddenly buy stock in those. And then when they merged, price goes way up. You've just made a fortune. And this is legal. So anyhow, that's what this is about. Are there any such things as honest politicians? No, not in my opinion. Nope. So anyhow, nobody wanted to touch the story. Nobody did touch the story. Not a single network, not a single news service did a single word on this. And so Glenn Greenwald had all the facts and he was going to break a story on it. Mind you, Glenn is a big supporter. He comes from the left, like many of us have. And they all went against him. So out of integrity, he said, I can no longer be a part of this. And left his own organization he co-created. Wow. How few journalists of integrity do we have left in America? How many Chris Hedges, Abby Martins? How many Glenn Fords? How many people do we have like that? Handful. But they're not in the mainstream media, so then why should we believe anything the mainstream media says about anything? We'll get to that in a moment. Anyhow, that's coming. Also, I want to thank one of our listeners for sending me a story. And that story, this was about Stephen Donziger, D-O-N-Z-I-N-G-E-R, about how there was a rally for him last night. And because the Justice Department went after him, after he won this remarkable Ecuadorian rainforest for the indigenous people, won that lawsuit that took years, but he won it. And then they went after him, and they managed just to destroy his life and bring charges against him. So I reached out. I called him. I spoke with him. So he'll be on our show on Tuesday. You'll hear his side of the story and how utterly corrupt our entire judicial system is. So thank you for sending me this. Again, when people send me things, I look at them. I read them. In fact, it was Greg Patton who sent me the person you're going to see on today's show, a Dr. Zelenko, Z-E-L-E-N-K-O. Never heard of him. Never knew anything about him. But boy, when I saw this video, and I'm going to play you right up to where it says what it has to say, but then there's another 45 minutes you can watch. And by the way, you can watch any of these video clips when we're playing. If you go to prn.fm, scroll down on the left-hand side, you'll see a box, and that's where those play. But this is a compelling story. Why? Because he's a regular family physician, board certified. He treats a lot of patients in the outpatient. He says that his goal is to keep patients from going into hospital by helping them when they're still an outpatient. And he saw that nothing was helping COVID at the beginning of this. People were dying like crazy. And then he read two articles. One article showed that a study with hydroxychloroquine with zinc allowed for some improvement in outcome. Another study was with the antibiotic zeromycin and hydroxychloroquine. So he thought to himself, there's no answers here. Let me use common sense and reason. If nobody has a solution, why not just combine the two together? And that's what he did. And hence, that was the beginning of using the three elements together. And he emphasizes zinc as crucial, including hydroxychloroquine, because he said this is very safe. It's like 29 cents a pill. And then he hammered the current drug that everybody in the media is favoring. Everybody, the New York Times, everybody, nothing but praise, praise, praise. Gotta go get it, gotta go get it. It's $3,200. Wow. And, oh, it just happens to be sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Anthony Fauci and the White House. And so he lays into it. I mean, a remarkable, candid, honest discussion of how is something we know works. And then he gives an example. Once he started talking with hundreds of physicians around the world, and he said, look, if you're attacking me, I've got 1,200 people, or whatever the number is, I think it was around 1,200, patients that I've treated. Two have died. That's it. I've got this huge success in getting my patients over their sickness. No toxicity, quickly and safely. How well are you doing in all the intensive care and all the hospitals and all the outpatients? You're not. You're failing. So then he goes after, well, why would we want a drug? Then he goes into the background on this drug. Well, what's wrong with this drug? Well, we've got brand new information today on that drug. We have looked at all the latest information. Mind you, this was only approved by the FDA in the last week. And now we have all the science showing it doesn't work. It's dangerous. Well, why would you allow a non-beneficial drug, and that's the latest study just out, and one that's dangerous, why would you promote that and not hydroxychloroquine in combination? Quote, this is from Science, one of the major peer review journals, yesterday. Quote, the very, very bad look of remdesivir, the first FDA-approved COVID-19 drug. Let me quote this. October was a good month for Gilead Sciences, the giant pharmaceutical and antiviral headquarters in Foster City, California. On October 8th, the company inked an agreement to supply the European Union with its drug as a treatment for COVID-19, a deal potentially worth more than $1 billion. 2 weeks later, on the 22nd, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved remdesivir for use against the pandemic coronavirus SARS-2 in the United States, the first drug to receive that status. Ah, the European Union and the United States decisions paved the way for the drug maker to enter two major markets, both with soaring COVID cases. But both decisions baffled scientists who have closely watched the clinical trials of the drug unfold over the past 6 months, and who have many questions about the drug's worth. At best, one large, well-designed study found the drug modestly reduced the time to recovery from COVID-19 in hospitalized patients with severe illness. A few smaller studies found no impact, no benefit of treatment on the disease whatever. Then, on October 15th, in this month's decidedly unfavorable news for Gilead, the fourth and largest controlled study delivered what some believe was a coup de grace. The World Health Organization's Solidarity trial showed that remdesivir does not reduce mortality, which means death, or the time COVID patients take to recover. Science has learned that both the FDA's decision and the European Union deal came about under unusual circumstances that gave the company important advantages. FDA never consulted a group of outside experts that it is at its ready to weigh in on complicated antiviral drug issues. The group, the Antimicrobial Drugs Advisory Committee, mixes infectious disease clinicians with biostatisticians, pharmacists, and a consumer representative to review all available data on experimental treatments and make recommendations to FDA about the drug approvals. Yet it has not convened once during the pandemic. The European Union, meanwhile, decided to settle on the drug's pricing, exactly 1 week before the disappointing Solidarity trial results came out. It was unaware of those results, although the manufacturer, as the trial sponsor, began to review the World Health Organization data on the 23rd of September and knew the trial was a bust. Quote, "This is very, very bad look for the FDA and the dealings with Gilead and the European Union make it another layer of badness," end quote. Now, I want you all to know that because this is real science and it's telling you the damn drug is a garbage drug. It should never have been. When we started telling you on this radio program that the initial results were terrible with high side effects, serious side effects, hospitalizations, everybody steamrolled it. Anthony Fauci is the culprit behind all this, and the drug, and all of their lobbyists, and the White House. All of them are responsible for this. So just remember, because when you get that information, you may not look at the other information that has good news, what you can do, and that is non-toxic. But we're not getting that information out. We're not sharing that. And there's some big studies on that. And we will be sharing all the good new studies. For example, I'll just give you one example. This is from The Lancet, and published in The Lancet, from the University of Manchester. Quote, "Vitamin D treatment is associated with reduced risk of mortality in patients with COVID-19, a cross-sectional multi-center observational study." Why isn't anyone promoting that? It's got all these universities involved with all their scientists. It's got the National Health Services Foundation Trust, that's Great Britain. It has the Leicester General Hospital. It has the Royal Infirmary. It has University of Manchester. It has all these scientists from all around saying that vitamin D taken by a person with COVID can reduce the incidence of death. It doesn't say that for remdesivir. So one, which is all corporate, all profit, all rotten to the core, no results. Vitamin D, inexpensive, easy, good results. That's how controlled. I've told you all along, you've been gamed. And by the way, why aren't we looking at Taiwan? Taiwan yesterday marked 200 days without domestic COVID-19 infection. That's correct. None. So we're not. Why aren't we taking a closer look at Sweden? But we're not. More on this to come. So that just shows you what the important stories that we're dealing with and will continue to deal with. And Mark Crispin Miller, professor at NYU, who teaches a class in propaganda, tenured professor, boy, they're going after him. They even have a faculty petition to have him thrown off the university. What, for teaching about propaganda? What's happened? All because one student complained who wasn't even his class? Wow. So we're having him on to talk about this. So as you see, we're in some fitting times now, and I will continue to bring forth people to use this platform who wish to challenge the status quo. And it's unfortunate because historically, the publications that we could count upon, the Mother Joneses, the Nation magazine, and Harper's, and Atlantic, and even at one time NPR, and others that were the bastions of challenging the corporatocracy and the military-industrial complex and the corruption within the deep state agencies like the CIA and National Security Agency, now they're all complicit. They've all been compromised. So that's where we're going. And if we go it alone, so be it. Imperial College London. How about this? Quote, "High vitamin A, E, and D intake is linked to fewer respiratory complaints in adults." This is published in the British Medical Journal this week. In fact, yesterday. So what is one of the side effects of the symptoms and full manifestation of COVID? Respiratory congestions that can lead to death if it is not treated. But high doses of vitamin A, E, and D is linked to fewer respiratory complaints in adults. The finding warrants further study among different ethnic groups and geographies in view of the current coronavirus pandemic, suggest the researchers. Well, if something will work in a person that is infected or has any form of upper respiratory tract infection, why wouldn't you assume that that might protect people who are otherwise healthy from becoming sick? That would be my suggestion. Separately, another study, University of Texas Medical Center, published in the Science of Translational Medicine, high sugar diet, that's your average American diet, that's the average British person's diet, can damage your gut and intensify the risks of colitis. Well, we've known that for a long time. Dr. John Yuckin, one of the first chairs of a department of health in all of Europe, and he was in London. I went over there to interview him back in 1971. He was the one who told us that. He was basing his work upon a Dr. John Cleave, a person who had been a Royal Navy medical doctor and saw that when they were eating canned foods and low-fiber foods on ships, that they all had constipation and all forms of blood pressure problems. But when they get to the islands and they could have fresh fruits and vegetables, they were able to clean themselves up. And so he came to the conclusion that we lack healthy fiber in the diet. That now today that's absolutely normal. Thousands of studies support that. At that time, he was the only one. And then a Dr. Dennis Burkitt, the discoverer of Burkitt's lymphoma, found, well, he was a visiting physician in East Africa at about 60, I think it was 67 hospitals, and he said it was rare to find any of the population dying of colorectal cancer, which is our number one killing cancer in America. It has surpassed lung cancer. And that's because people had high roughage in the diet. Isn't it amazing? People in the 1960s were discovering things and writing about it, but there was no market for that information. People weren't willing to hear it. So just letting you know, high sugar consumption, worse colitis, and all forms of irritable bowel conditions. Take your probiotics, keep your intestines healthy. And finally, from the University of Maryland Medical Center, laughter improves your health. This is directly from the center. It says, quote, for seniors, laughter may be the best medicine to improve quality of life and health. And what is laughter? Well, laughter is a series of inarticulate sounds produced as an expression of emotion, usually happiness or mirth. Well, because we laugh an average of 17 times a day, unless you're a corporate Democrat, they don't laugh their entire life. Let me out so I can laugh. No, no. God. Unless it's one of those fake Hillary laughs, and that's not a laugh. That belongs in a horror film, Friday the 13th. Because we laugh 17 times a day, you'd think that we're immune to bad health. Turns out those who laugh 40% less than the average have cardiovascular disease. And it's been shown that the areas of the brain that recognize humor are not as active in those with heart disease. So one more reason to laugh. Why? Simple. The frontal lobe responsible for emotional outlet, the left side interprets words. The right side determines what makes a joke funny. And in young people, there is no such thing as a funny joke. I'm offended by everything you say. Good. I'll laugh about that. You won't. You're anally tight. In fact, you're so anally tight that when you die, they'll have to split the skin on your ass to get your eyes closed. Just kidding. We don't want to hear any comedian ever again. You won't, because no comedian is going to go out there and risk being shamed by some idiot who is living in a bubble of non-consequence, but it's happening. So just remember, those of you who can't laugh, who take everything so seriously, who, you know, you can't have a conversation without your whole body going into some spastic, tight-ass position, lighten up. Or maybe it's time for a lobotomy to remove those frontal lobes so you can just laugh at anything. Because the brain's limbic system is responsible for basic reactions like surprise and fear and hunger. And finally, the motor areas of the brain become active and they're responsible for the chuckle. But have you seen any of the comedians on late night television since Jay Leno or who are actually funny? I can't watch them because they try to be ironic instead of funny. And there's nothing funny about bitches being ironic. you don't see Jonathan Winters or probably the funniest of all, who's also the most offensive, and that's what made him funny, was Don Rankles and Robin Williams. No, you don't see him, and you're not going to kill that. But if you want to laugh, you're also improving your immune system. Negative thoughts manifest in chemical reactions that can affect your body by bringing more stress into the system and decreasing immunity. That's a fact. Also, laughter inhibits pain. There was a study out of Oxford University showing that. It stimulates the release of endorphins, just like when you do a runner's high. And so it helps just to reduce all forms of pain, and it improves your blood vessel dilation, which lowers your blood pressure and prevents clots from forming and reduces inflammation. But if you live in a bubble, everything is so serious. Yeah, too bad. Back in a moment, and when we come back, we're going directly into this clip. Now, mind you, I'm not going to tell you more about it than there's a sad part to this clip, a very sad part. So I'm going to try to have this doctor on the program next week to tell the back end of this story, because for creating a protocol that all these other doctors around the United States and world are using, do you remember I had the doctor on who began to use hydroxychloroquine with zinc and azithromycin? Well, now you know where all these people got their original information. This guy you're going to hear in a moment. And he didn't do it for the fame, but boy, did he get surprised when all the attacks, all, as you'll hear him say, all the liberal media went after him. Wow, all the liberal media is going after now one of the ultimate liberals, an honest one, corporate liberal media, and that is Glenn Greenwald. Huh. Interesting. Think about it. Back in a moment with his clip.
Dr. Mobeen Sayed from drbeen.com. Today is a super exciting day. This day has come after many, many weeks of waiting. We have the beloved, the awesome, amazing Dr. Zelenko with us. Dr. Zelenko has been treating COVID-19 patients in outpatient setting for, I believe, now months now, and successfully. And not only that, he is an outspoken, brave leader for the cheap and inexpensive treatment with hydroxychloroquine-based protocols. So, Dr. Zelenko, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
So first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry I didn't come on sooner. I had some issues come up. But I am 46 years old. I've been a family physician for 20 years, educated and trained in New York. And married, I have 8 children. And I grew up in New York, Brooklyn, even though I was born in Ukraine. I was born in Kiev. And oh, wow. My family emigrated when I was 4 years old to Brooklyn. So, that's my kind of a quick background. I've been a family physician for a large community of 35,000 people. Wow. And they all live within a square mile, very high population density. Hmm. And that's how I got kind of sucked into this COVID pandemic. I didn't choose it. It chose me, because my community got hit in the beginning of March, and everyone got sick at once because of the population density. And my office, instead of seeing 50 patients a day, which was the average, we were seeing 250. And all the outpatient services, like the laboratories and the imaging places, the radiology, were all closed because of the pandemic. So, and half my staff got sick. So it was a war zone. It was the way that I had to practice medicine completely changed overnight, where you had to rely on intuition and triage and just common sense. You had no resources. So it was like as if a bomb went off and you have multiple casualties and you're understaffed and you just do the best you can. So it was a disaster. And what were we offering patients at that time? If you remember, the whole world at that time was focused on respirators. We need more respirators. No one was talking about pre-hospital intervention to help people so that they don't need respirators, which didn't make sense to me because that's what we do with every other condition, right? So I started doing my research, and I looked around what different countries were doing. So I looked in the Far East, South Korea actually, and they were using hydroxychloroquine and zinc. Some mild success, and they were using it in patients. Then I looked in France, Dr. Dudé-Raoul in Marseille, he was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin with some success. So I realized, but I found myself in a different setting. I was in an outpatient setting. I'm not a hospital, I'm not a hospitalist. I'm not treating patients. My job is to keep people out of the hospital. So I decided, well, let me make a regimen. Let's see how things go. Trial and error, you know? And so I combined the Far East approach with the French approach. So hydroxychloroquine was the common denominator. Azithromycin, the most common antibiotic I use. And zinc is just an element. I mean, so I had the 20 years experience with the hydroxychloroquine. I've been using it for my rheumatological patients and for my patients that travel abroad to endemic areas where malaria is. So I would give them for prophylaxis. So it was a drug that I was very familiar with. And I used to give it to pregnant women and to children. So all these drugs were safe and known to me. They were cheap and they were available at that time. So I combined it into like this three drug approach. But more important than that, I developed selection criteria or risk stratification criteria to choose the patients I'm going to treat. And the reason why I did that was, if you looked around in the hospitals, I was looking at who are the people that are dying. So it was the people over the age of 60 or younger people, but they had other problems, they had comorbidities. That's it. So I looked around and said, okay, this virus is not killing people equally. It's picking on the vulnerable. It's attacking those that are sick and old. And I looked at all the young people that were getting it. They're all getting better without any intervention. So it made sense to me that with the limited resources that I have, I'm going to triage the high-risk patients. And then, more important than anything, was to intervene immediately based on clinical suspicion and not wait for confirmatory testing. And that was very simple. Why? Because if you look at the viral load dynamics of COVID, the first 5 days of symptoms, the virus essentially is constant in terms of concentration. Around day six, it explodes like a wildfire. Now, I don't know in your experience, but in my experience, most patients come to the doctor between day four and five. Similar. Because it goes like the first 2 days, they're sick, they think they're going to get better. The third day, they see they're not getting better, so they call the doctor, and they get an appointment either the next day or the day after that. So we're by day four and five. Is that what your experience is?
It's very similar. And as what I have seen is, too, most of the cases are these within third, fourth day when they feel that it is not going away. And the second one I've seen is that when they have started doing things that we say, you know, the administrations say, take Tylenol or take, you know, cough syrups, and that doesn't work. And they become more worried and the breathing starts becoming disturbed. That is when they become really panicky as well. And they start seeking help. But you are correct. Majority is in those days.
So think through it. If they come to me on day four or five, and I'm going to do a test, and it takes, at that time, it took 3 to 4 days to get the test results. So I have someone on day five, I do a test, and I would send them home with nothing. And when the test came back on day nine, I would call them back and say, you have COVID, we need to treat you. It was stupid, because by then they were really sick. So what I decided to do is, I'm just going to treat them empirically. It was easy to diagnose simply because it wasn't flu season. It was the first batch of testing that I did came back 65% positive. It's flu-like symptoms, and they would lose their smell and taste, which is pretty pathognomonic for a COVID. Not many other things do that. Absolutely. And with exposure, it just made common sense to diagnose them based on clinical suspicion. And what I noticed was, if I would intervene early within the first 5 days with high-risk patients, they stopped getting sick. They stopped going to the hospital.
Yes, yes.
And I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, it's like I fell upon a kind of formula that really made a difference. Hmm. And I don't take credit for it. I really believe it's from God. I don't think it's me. And so let me give you an analogy that imagine this, you have a soldier on the front lines, a simple soldier, a private, and he stumbles across some very important maps, intelligence. And he looks, and the maps tell you where the enemy is and where their weapons are. And he realizes, you know, this could help win the war. I need to get it to the big general right away. So that's how I felt. I felt, wait a minute. I'm not stupid. I knew what I found. People were stopping to die. So I said, I need to get it to the most powerful man on the planet. So I asked my 17-year-old son to help me make a YouTube video, because I'd never made a YouTube video. And I made a video to the President of the United States. That was, I think, March 21st. And I asked him for help. I said, whatever. I said, listen, I found something. I think it's important. I need to talk to you. So the next day, his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, calls me on my cell phone. Do you understand what I call you? It's like,
yes.
So, so I started, I told him what I was doing. He was really interested. It was just the beginning, so I didn't have too much data. He said, please keep us updated. You know, and I did. And then Stephen Hahn, the commissioner of the FDA, called me on my cell phone. Then I got Rudy Giuliani called me. And he's the president's private attorney. And I did a few podcasts with him, which went absolutely viral, like millions of people started. And at that point, everyone started calling me. At this point, I've given consultations to seven governments.
I can imagine.
Certain countries are literally following my protocol as a standard of care. So that's how it all evolved. So from March till June, by end of June, we were kind of not seeing any more new patients with COVID. My group, my practice, saw 2,200 COVID-19 patients. And out of those 2,200, we basically stratified 800 of them as high risk. And high risk here means a 5% mortality rate. That group, 5% were dying. So if you take 800 and take 5%, it's 40 patients. You would have assumed 40 dead people and a multiple of that on ventilators. My results were 2 people died and 4 others were on a ventilator. They all got extubated and they're all doing fine. So, I mean, that's a significant, several orders of magnitude better outcome than anyone else was seeing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then I was contacted by 2 world-class researchers, Dr. Martin Schultz and Dr. Roland Derwand. They're professors from Germany who have had many years of research experience, published hundreds of articles in the best journals. And they contacted me and they said that they really want to work together with me to bring my data to the world. And I'm not a researcher. I said, absolutely. And we collaborated together. And the first week of July, we put out a paper, which I think you have. The paper is in preprint form. And I think it's the, yeah, that's it. It was at one point, it had something like 160,000 views already. Mm-hmm. 156,000, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we submitted it now for peer review, which is, takes a few months. And we're at the end of that process. We actually heard back from the journal. They really liked it. They needed some clarification on some points, which we're doing now. We're going to resubmit it. And I hope very soon it will be published in a very, in a world-class journal, peer-reviewed, and then could be considered legitimate science.
Awesome. Because, awesome.
You know, it's a process I've learned. But my point is that in the process of trying to bring this information to the world, I came across a lot of opposition, intense opposition. And I didn't understand why. I mean, I understand now, but at that time, it just didn't make sense. And ultimately, it came down to, you know, what's motivating you? Are you viewing human life as something that has sanctity?
Yeah, so I have a cat here, which, yeah. Sorry about that.
No worries. So either life has sanctity because we're made in the image of God, or we're nothing more than animals, and like animals can be bought and sold, our lives can be bought and sold. It depends how you want to look at, it. Apparently, there's enough people in this world that view us as animals. Hmm. So, for example, the pharmaceutical industry benefits tremendously from hospitalized patients when it comes to COVID-19.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because drugs like remdesivir and now the convalescent plasma and the IL-6 inhibitors, all these very expensive treatments are reserved for inpatient care. Hmm. Now, if we prevent patients from going down to the hospital, so for example, my data showed an 84% reduction in the need for hospitalization. 84%.
That is a huge reduction.
And so that means 84% reduction in the market share for drugs like remdesivir. Mm-hmm. So that was one element. But the pharmaceutical industry, which has a lot of money, resources, political influence, and so on. Like if you look at FDA's, 50% of the budget of the FDA is getting the pharmaceutical industry. And so on. So there was a lot of conflict of interest. And then it just happened that we're right before an American presidential election. And the president, it's a matter of record, came out in support of the use of hydroxychloroquine.
He did, yeah.
It's an important drug. So anyone who was against him, or many people that were against him, did not want him to have a political win. So they began to vilify hydroxychloroquine, not because of medical reasons, but for political reasons. Absolutely. In a sense, let me translate to you what that means. They were ready to sacrifice a portion of our population.
And I think and they are still continuing with that opposition.
Okay, that's a part of the interview. What's important is to realize that this man, after making such a success of having over 80% of his patients who tested positive and had symptoms, did not have to go to hospital and were recovered completely, and only two in that, all those over 1,000 patients died. Compare that to any other medical situation, and you'll see why that's remarkable. But then the attacks came. They've been nonstop. His character, everything about him has been attacked. In fact, I just read this morning the Times of Israel that said that, quote, Jewish MD who promoted virus cocktails leaving community where he tested it. And that goes into how he was, in effect, asked to leave the Orthodox community because he was suggesting that the people should be tested and treated to help them prophylactically, and otherwise a high percentage could come down with the infection. And there was enormous pushback on that. So now he is no longer affiliated with that community. And on top of it, I'll just tell you what the next part of the interview was. It doesn't deal with the virus. It deals with the other medical doctor, who uses the same protocol, by the way, saying, how do you have the courage to come in each day knowing that you're going to be attacked by all the mainstream media for saving your patient's life using a cocktail that Anthony Fauci and others disagree with? Here's what he said. He said just a few years ago, he thought that he just had a health problem with a blood clot. But when they went in and did all these exams and then did surgery, they found out that he had cancer on his heart, very rare. I think he said there's only been 250 cases in all recorded history of this. And a very complex operation, and they had to resection part of his arteries, and it was open heart surgery, major operation. And so when he was recovering from that, he realized that he had been given the gift of life. He had faced death. He said he was ready to talk with his children about his passing. And it was very challenging, very difficult, as it would be for anyone. And but he was fortunate enough to have had the best of medicine help him. But just recently, he went in for his checkup and found out it had all grown back again and had metastasized. Well, to give you an idea, when you have his particular type of cancer, metastasized is almost always a death sentence. So that's really sad. And yet he says that I'm not afraid, because once you face death and you're still alive after facing it, what else can happen to you? What can someone say to you to be worse than that? And I thought about that, and I thought, wow, he's absolutely correct. And that's why some people have gone through devastating circumstances in their life of different types, end up being stronger because of it, because they broke through instead of breaking down. And then they really begin to appreciate life. Having counseled tens of thousands of people, many terminally ill, almost all terminally ill in the last many, many years, to have someone who years later is alive and well, they don't take a single day for granted. They're very aware that they came real close to having no more days. So any day they have is a gift and it's a blessing. So don't waste it. Don't get morose. Don't get into a negative mindset. Rejoice in the life that you have. Even if you can't change all the circumstances, you can change your perception of those circumstances. There was also one of the great, well, he was a psychiatrist, but he was also a philosopher. And I'm sure most of you know who I'm talking about. Certainly all the people who are Jewish in this audience know, and those who read the important self-help literature from the 1950s and 60s. A young boy, 5 years old, went to five different concentration camps and survived, and he would later say, having something to believe in that was more important than the crisis you were facing gave you the edge. Viktor Frankl was his name. I suggest you all read his seminal work. It's as good as the best of Rollo May, Man's Search for Himself, and Eric Fromm, and others who were guiding lights to open doors. Anyhow, I'm going to take some calls now. If you'd like to call in, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. So now he's without his larger community. He has saved a lot of lives. He's been attacked, and he will continue to be attacked, and he's terminally ill. And still he's still staying positive. Good for him. Because all these other doctors using this combination, now you know where one of the people who brought that forward, where this came from. I'm Gary Nall, and while our engineers in New York are gearing up to take your call at 888-874-4888, I don't know if we'll have time to play this. No, let's just see if we get this. In the interim, until I get a note here, I just want to give you a few insights. There's an interesting article today in Climate News Network. At all of the different causes, including the seeding of the clouds and the chemtrails. Here's what they say, quote, geoengineering is probably not a good idea. quote from Skyseed, geoengineering the planet might be humankind's last desperate throw, such a tale by a geophysical hazard expert. And it shows why it's not going to work. I would agree with that. And yet Bill Gates and many other people are putting money behind some form of chemical seeding, and it would be extremely toxic. And when it gets out of the atmosphere, it's going to fall into the water and soil. And we're talking about huge amounts, unheard of amounts, to try to create a cloud, a cover, like an umbrella, out of chemicals, genetically engineered materials. Not a good idea. So let's hope that they don't do it. Instead, things that we know could work and we could do immediately and within our control is just go to a plant-based, local, supported diet. Eat organic, locally grown, plant-based, give up dairy, give up meat and chicken and fish, give up all the things that have a heartbeat or face. That is an enormous advantage. Then let's start planting trees, something that we have unemployed people who would be more than happy to work in each area of each state. And we could plant 1 billion trees a year because at the same time we're doing this, the Amazon, because of Bolsonaro, the completely corrupt president, is allowing it just to be completely exploited. But keep in mind, if you're waiting for the government to come together and say, yes, let's not just use platitudes and campaign speeches, let's actually do something, it's never going to happen. Because anyone who decides maybe it's a good thing that we did something for the environment, really good, like starting to harness geothermal, which is everywhere, they're not going to do it. And that's totally non-polluting. Harness wave power around the entire United States and all the Great Lakes and the Gulf of Mexico, it's not going to happen. And yet that's something that doesn't pollute, and you have a constant source of waves 24/7, so it would be a constant source of energy. Promoting the bladeless wind turbines that a person could put on their roof and could produce enough wattage for one house per day. Well, what if we subsidize everyone who had a house and made that important? Subsidizing, let's say, the type of thermal insulation that is non-toxic that can control the heat in the winter and summer, and also solar paint, so that when the sun hits your house in Florida, in Texas, in California, Arizona, Nevada, very hot places, you're actually then able to use that. So these are things we could do that are natural, non-toxic, that we're not doing. And let's not wait for the environmental groups, because they've been substantially captured by the Al Gore phenomena. And we don't have any calls. Okay. Next week, we got a lot of interesting people coming on. Interesting because they've all done the right thing for the right reasons, and now they're all being attacked by the government, its agencies. But now let's use the same argument. Let's say that you've been listening to this program where I tell you to wash your hands, hyper hygiene. I tell you to use gloves when you go out. I do, have for years, decades. People thought it was strange and absurd, but I'm the one who didn't come down with the parasites. But also to protect yourself, and that's what I do. But also, I build up my immune system every day. I make sure I exercise. I make sure I have a healthy plant-based diet and juices. I make sure I'm taking all the supplements that I know, like zinc and selenium and vitamin C and vitamin D and vitamin A. These are not expensive, and they build up your immune system. So when I come in contact where I might otherwise come down with an infection, that this is protecting me. Now, that should be information that everyone is told. Now, Anthony Fauci, I have the actual recording where he said, oh, yeah, I take my vitamin D and vitamin C, and et cetera. Well, why doesn't he share that with everyone? And yet he'll tell you all about this one drug that they made, the drug that everyone's going to be given in hospital, and it's completely failed, and it's got serious side effects. So just having that knowledge allows you to say, what can I do to prevent this? Then you start looking for complementary medical doctors, board certified in their field, who then are beginning to use frontline non-toxic and natural treatments wherever possible, and then also orthodox drugs that are non-toxic. And by the way, all the studies show in the proper doses hydroxychloroquine is non-toxic. What they said is damaging to the heart is not, but the other drugs are. In fact, guess what is now shown to have toxic effects on your heart? You guessed it, the very drug that has just been given FDA approval is the drug of choice, going to be promoted everywhere by all of medicine, but individual doctors are gathering courage. Remember when just a handful, I played you the first video, frontline doctors, they're called, were on the steps of the Supreme Court, and there was no one there. Camera turned around, there was no one there. One person filming it. But that one person filming it, they suddenly had like 5 million people watching it because they were telling the truth. None of them knew each other. They were all strangers. They were all orthodox doctors, pro-vaccine, etc. But they knew that what we were doing by keeping people who did not test positive, younger people who were healthy and children, out of school and out of work was wrong. They were right. With all the lockdowns we've had in Great Britain and the United States, it's not worked at all. It's been just to the contrary, as we've shown by the actual figures. Now, also know that because right now, today, every newspaper in the world is telling you how bad it is because there's a spike in coronavirus cases. Not true. There's a spike in positive testing, but we've also broken that down, showing you the PCR test being used is not accurate. And I've got 4 different studies today, just today, from mainstream science showing that. And they're guessing. The actual number that CDC of people who have actually died from coronavirus is 6%. Well, that does make it a pandemic. That's not even as bad as a serious flu season. So we have been lied to. Why? What is the motive? Why would they have to game the numbers? Because most people who get tested who are positive, they can't distinguish, is that an old virus that's dead? Is it an old part of a virus? They can't distinguish that. They have to keep multiplying it through PCR, meaning amplifying it. Well, once you get up to 50 amplifications to finally see that you've got a virus there, the doctor is going to get a report back saying positive. Well, positive or something is not infective, can't affect them or anybody else. They're not told that. Now there's a whole group of scientists advocating that there's a cutoff. If you test positive under this number, you're active. You can spread the virus. If you test positive after this number of replications, it's so tiny that you had to do it 40 or 50 times just to find the damn virus. And you can't even distinguish if it's the current virus or an older COVID virus. So all this is based upon unfounded and incomplete and inaccurate science. You know that. Your neighbor doesn't. You know what to look for. You know how to protect yourself. Now look for doctors who are willing to give you the type of inpatient care, meaning in their office, so that in effect it's outpatient, so you can get your whatever you think is important. If you start to have symptoms, the key is the first 24 hours is what's important, and then you see if it's improving, and if they put you on one of the medications they believe are important. And you look at the scientific literature on it, and there are over 54 studies now supporting, in the peer-reviewed literature, supporting hydroxychloroquine. Mind you, you've never heard me promoting any drug. But when something works and it can save lives, then I want you to know about it. What you do is up to you. So you see, you're acting as if you're helpless on all levels, so why care? And I'm saying you have an enormous amount you can do to make a difference in your own life and those of the people you care about. But now do your resourcing. Go out and find those doctors. They exist. And then become a patient. So at least you know if you have any health problems, you or your family, there's someone who will not just throw you into that conundrum that you're concerned about, rightly so, of giving you the latest Anthony Fauci-promoted drug, which is worthless and dangerous. They'll look at other ways. They might give you intravenous vitamin C. They might give you ozone, both of which have been shown to be beneficial for upper respiratory tract infections and COVID. But no one's talking about that. Okay? Look at the good side of this. You have knowledge. You have power with that knowledge. Now, look at the next step. Find people that you can connect with in the professional field that when you need something, you got it. When I need to get my teeth cleaner, I need once a year to get my teeth examined, I have a holistic dentist. And I go to her, and she takes a look. But what if I didn't have a holistic dentist? I have a holistic ophthalmologist check my eyes once a year. I have You know, so I have, and you could have the same thing. And there's lots of resources to tell you who in the field are good in looking at life from a different perspective. Okay? Thank you for your call, Duke. I appreciate it. And thank all of you for listening. And have a nice day.